Coming up today, you'll never believe what Facebook is clamping down on in its news feeds. Click this podcast to see the shocking, unbelievable news. Plus, as Amazon buys Twitch, we wonder, WTF happened to the deal we thought was going through that would see YouTube acquire the video game's live streaming service? And after 189 episodes, we finally have a reason for Katie to talk about cheese, robots, and pizza in the same sentence. It'll be great. In addition to your feedback this week, including a rant from somebody I'm related to, we delve into a rumor sack and pull out an iPhone 6, a massive 12-inch iPad, an iWatch, and a whole load of question marks. Are they real? Do we want them? All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to cheese news and clickbait. I'm your host, Nick Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And, oh no, that deafening silence. It's a void left by Olivia Solon. However, welcome to the first episode of Katie as a regular co-host.
Hooray!
Yeah. Sadly, no Liat today because she's on holiday taking a well-earned rest.
Yes.
I said, switch off your email, switch off your phone, don't get in touch, don't do anything, go and relax.
A little bit like what we talked about on our last few podcasts.
Yes. And do you know what she said?
What?
She said, okay, here's my husband's mobile number just in case you need something. I was like, honestly, what have I bred
dedicated
in her? Honestly, dedication, yes. But we are going to be sans Liv, obviously, from now on, because she has left Wired, as noted in the last episode, which also means we're sans Beazle, the office dog.
Oh.
Although, I was thinking about getting office giant African land snails.
Okay.
But before that, the news. Facebook, that little site, it's cracking down on the frequent appearance of clickbait headlines in news feeds in a move that could spell disaster to sites heavily reliant on social traffic, such as BuzzFeed and Upworthy. Now, Facebook defines clickbait headlines as those posted with a headline that encourages people to click to see more without providing them with much information about what they'll actually see. These are the ones you'll all have seen them before. It's, you know, you'll never believe this photo, or can you guess what happens next, or you know, those sorts of ones, because they get really bad. You've seen them, Katie.
Oh yes. I mean, I think these things are just that they're very aware that people are just kind of getting a massive slew of these posts in their newsfeed, and they don't necessarily want to see them.
No.
And the reason that they're kind of going up in the rankings and in Facebook's algorithm is because people are clicking through because of that kind of sort of shock factor, like,
yeah,
we don't know what we're going to see. But they're not actually what people really care about, and they're not.
That's right.
They're not really appealing to people in the way that Facebook, I think, wants content to appeal to people, which I think is a really good thing.
I think it's a good thing. They have a very high bounce rate, those sorts of stories, which is that people click on them, they stay for a very, very short period of time, sometimes just a few seconds, and then go back. Mm. And that's seen as a bad thing. In the Google world, Google actually de-ranks websites that have a very high bounce rate. So if you're seen as you have a website or a web page that people go to but then immediately leave consistently, then Google will devalue that search result because it thinks, well, actually, it might look on the surface like this is a relevant story to give to this search result, but actually user experience en masse suggests that it's not. So that gets deranked to make the Google experience better. And that's kind of, it looks like, what Facebook is doing now, which anyone who's seen this happen before in the SEO world and in the trying to be the first at the top of Google, we've seen this happen before, and you don't rely on something like Facebook for all your traffic. But it could be quite concerning for the sites that do. Now, primarily, Facebook, as Katie says, is worried that clickbait content is drowning out content that's generally or genuinely of interest to people, and therefore responsible for turning people off the social network. So it's tweaking its algorithm, and it will mean that it's going to be a lot harder for publishers to manipulate Facebook to sort of guarantee a viral success, as it were, which I think overall is a good thing. It's certainly good for publishing, because personally I detest this practice of clickbaity headlines, and you know, we don't do it, and there's a reason that we don't do it consistently, because they're crap and I hate them.
Yeah, I would be interested to see if Facebook's concerned about this, because it's seen a drop in engagement and a drop in people actually using the social network because of these articles filling people's news feeds.
I think possibly it could be, but also compounding that problem is the fact that with so many publishers trying to mimic the quote-unquote BuzzFeed way of doing this, that it's now even more frequently seen from other publishers. So they're all competing for the same audience, which previously might have been acceptable if it was just a couple of sites. Yeah. But with everybody doing it, there's so much noise, such a bad experience. Facebook's like, you know what? No. And frankly, at this point in time, if Facebook is going to switch off something like that, it could kill some sites pretty much dead overnight, as if they'd back in the day fallen off Google. Yeah. We'll have to keep our eye on it, of course. But let us know if you think this is a good move or not. Are you going to be happy to see your newsfeed cleaned up by the Facebook algorithm? podcast@wired.co.uk. Amazon has bought up the 3-year-old video game live streaming service Twitch in a deal that is valued at just under $1 billion, $970 million to be precise, which is £585 million when I wrote this story and converted it. that may be higher or lower, but it's around just under £600 million. So brilliant for a company that is only 3 years old. Fantastic. But it is a surprise move, I think, that has caused quite a few heads to turn in the industry, because about a month ago, it was reported by lots of people that Google had signed a deal to buy Twitch. And now it seems that obviously, if that was the case, Jeff Bezos came in and gave them more money, and Google maybe didn't want that to pay anymore, and Amazon offered more.
I was under the impression that it was a kind of done deal with Google. I didn't read loads into it, and it also seemed to really make sense for Google given YouTube and
absolutely know, the idea was sound. Google integrates it into YouTube or leaves it as Twitch, and as soon as the live stream has finished, then the full version of that video gets archived straight onto YouTube. That's what they do with Google Hangouts on Air, or offers the option to do, and it's a great way of doing it. YouTube's the archive, Hangouts or Twitch in this case is the live streaming platform. It's a match made in heaven, and it certainly could have made Google a hell of a lot of money, given that Twitch is sort of now the go-to standard. It's built into PS4, it's built into Xbox, it's built into everything. I mean, it's even built in some iPad games. I mean, Asphalt 8, which is a really popular racing game on the iPad, has Twitch streaming built into it. You can stream your gameplay on an iPad within the app. They support that. So it's crazy how well Twitch has done.
So do you think this is a kind of surprise move for Amazon, or does it make sense for them as well?
It's a really good question. It's not a surprising move in that it seems like a bad fit. It's a surprising move that Google didn't get the deal.
Right.
I mean, Amazon's been steadily buying up loads of streaming services to compete with things like Netflix. So you remember Love Film, a UK-based company, that was bought by Amazon about three years ago. And then in 2014, that was rebadged as Amazon Prime Instant Video, because that's what the streaming service that Amazon runs in the US is called. Plus games aren't really a new interest for Amazon, because it's got a really big investment obviously in its app store, which provides games for its Fire products like the Kindle Fire and Fire TV, which has been out for a little while and hopefully will come here at some point. We think it might do. And the latter, the Fire TV, actually has a games controller specifically for playing games on TV. And Amazon, let's not forget, makes its own games. It has the Amazon Game Studio, which was kickstarted when they bought the company that makes the Killer Instinct games and Silent Hill Homecoming, as one example, Double Helix, which it bought, I think, at the start of this year, maybe February. So all of those things together, it wants to be in streaming, it wants to make original content in the gaming world and obviously in the TV world, which we've talked about in the past. So why wouldn't it buy Twitch? The only thing now is that it means Google, possibly, if it was so interested in buying Twitch, maybe it might start now to do its own thing and set up a competing service. And that could get very interesting, I think.
I just think, given Google's recent acquisition history, they wouldn't have let this go if they'd really, really wanted it. You know, I just...
Potentially, but at the same time, it's a lot of money. I mean... It's not a lot of money for Google or Amazon, I suppose, less so for Google. But there does come a point when if you actually think you can make a better return and a better business by doing it yourself, then you should.
Yeah.
And competition is never a bad thing for the consumer. So I think this is a great move.
Cool. When it comes to handling a medical emergency, you might think your only option really is to call an ambulance and wait till the paramedics arrive. But what you might not know is that, in fact, there are about 1,500 people across the UK, 1,000 of which are in London, who are currently signed up as Good Samaritans, who can also kind of come in and help if there is a medical emergency. So these Good Samaritans are volunteers who are trained what they call first responders, and in fact many are off-duty doctors, nurses, paramedics, medical students, etc. Anyone can be one, and currently the London Air Ambulance is trying to recruit more. Now you might be thinking, yes, but how do I get in touch with these Good Samaritans in a medical emergency?
I was thinking that.
Yes, well, there's a new app that's been partly launched by the London Air Ambulance Service that's called Good Sam, and what it's doing is it's making it easier to find Good Samaritans during an emergency when they're nearby.
Is this kind of like Uber for healthcare?
In a way, yes.
Like, who's the nearest Good Samaritan near me? I've just broken my leg, or I think somebody might be having a heart attack.
Yes, it's almost exactly like that.
Except that's brilliant.
It's more charitable.
That's brilliant.
Yes. So what you can do is and anybody can do this. In fact, the London Air Ambulance are encouraging people to download this on their phone in case of an emergency. And what will happen is if something terrible happens, you can open the app, you just press one button, and with that one button, it will send out alerts to Good Samaritans that are nearby, informing them, you know, giving them the GPS location of where you are, and at the same time, it calls an ambulance. So you don't have to choose and think, oh, what do I do first? So it has this kind of simultaneous function. And then the Good Samaritans, in turn, can then respond and let you know if they can make it, you know, if they're available to come and help. And the app also has a messaging function, so you can kind of talk back and forth with them. It will direct then the Good Samaritans to the nearest defibrillator, because there are also secreted around in public spaces defibrillators in case of emergencies.
Yeah, I've seen them actually quite a lot in the underground. In the underground. And I think I remember reading a fact that every minute saved gives someone either a 10% better chance of surviving, every minute saved with CPR or defibrillator, it reduces the survival chances of someone having a heart attack by 10% for every minute, something like that. Those first few minutes can make a
really
massive
crucial
difference to someone's survival chances.
Yeah, and you know, if you think about the difficulties that an ambulance might have getting there, I mean, the idea that somebody can come and perform these, you know, kind of basic first aid things, really, but, you know, really give somebody a better chance of surviving. I mean, this is really a fantastic thing. And, you know, if you want to sign up to become a Good Samaritan, you can do. But, you know, we'd recommend that maybe you download the app and you can become an alerter.
Mm.
Which is the opposite, I guess.
That's the one where you need help.
Yes.
So you're the customer, not the utility provider.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah, and there are 5,000 medical emergencies in London alone every day. So, you know, it's not.
Is that sort of like street emergencies? Because to me, actually, 5,000 medical emergencies doesn't sound like that many for a city with the population of London. I would have thought there'd be far more. I mean,
no, I don't think it's sort of on the street. I think, you know, probably
major
5,000, you know, ambulances.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, 5,000. Yeah, I suppose that seems like a more reasonable figure. Think about it like that. Yeah, I'm just thinking like the number of people that might need some healthcare in London all day, it's got to be more than 5,000.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I see what you mean.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, we've got a story on the website. If you search Good Sam, or one word, I think you will find our story. And let us know if you've had any connection or experience with this, or if you think this is something you would like. And can you think of any examples in which this might be a bad idea or a really particularly good idea? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk.
Nate, I wrote a story I was really, really excited about this
week. I know, because it was to do with food. And
it
that's
was.
Like, porn.
Not only food, but my favourite food, which is cheese.
Yes.
So The question that I asked is, what is the ultimate combination of pizza cheese?
Since I only eat Cathedral City and don't like pizza, I'm pretty much the worst person to ask.
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, and it might to some people seem like quite a trivial question, but in fact, there's been a study done by some food technologists at the University of Melbourne.
I love that that's a job title.
I know.
Food technologist. It's almost as good as astronaut.
And these food technologists have been investigating different combinations of cheese to see how their various kind of composition and functional qualities affect the browning and blistering of the pizza topping. So in this study, the researchers explained how they used machine vision, so basically used robots, to assess the visual appearance of the cheese on pizzas which obviously had been baked. Now, the reason that they did this is that the way that food looks can dramatically affect the way that you kind of experience it.
Is that the kind of the first bite is with the eye?
Exactly.
Which, if taken literally, is a horrifying way to chew a food.
Yes.
Ooh. With your eyelids.
I'd rather not think about that. But okay. But I mean, and obviously this doesn't matter perhaps so much if you're making it yourself, but obviously a lot of pizza is sold either by sort of takeaway pizza places or by supermarkets. So pizza manufacturers like their pizza to look a certain way in order to make it the most appealing.
Okay, so what types of cheese? I'm guessing Cathedral City wasn't part of this study, which rules out mine. We're not sponsored by Cathedral City, by the way. I just happen to give them a lot of my money. Well, but what types of cheese were used? I can see mozzarella listed
yes.
here.
Yes, so obviously mozzarella, which is the traditional pizza cheese, and they didn't specify Cathedral City, but they did use cheddar. I mean, obviously this study was done in Australia. I'm not sure if they have Cathedral City over there. Also Colby, Edam, Emmental, Gruyere and provolone.
I've heard of none of those. I've heard of Edam. I've heard of Emmental because that's the one that you can the one that I buy when I'm in like Germany and yeah. I can't buy proper cheddar.
Yeah. Gruyere is a personal favourite of mine. But so the reason, obviously not all of these are traditional pizza cheeses by any means, but the reason that they started to mess around with all the different cheeses was to deliberately kind of push material properties and composition properties away from what's typical, and to go for cheese that's not normally on a pizza as the way to find the best combination. Now, what they were looking for was something that should have distinct patches with that toasty cheese colour and a uniform golden brown background.
Mm.
Yeah, so they were looking to create this fail-safe formula that would, you know, have this perfect pockmarked golden pizza. And what they found was that cheddar, Colby and Edam don't blister because they're too elastic.
Okay.
In their properties.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so Gruyere, provolone and Emmental, on the other hand, don't brown very easily as the free oil that kind of moves around prevents moisture from evaporating. But they found that the combination of these three cheeses with blistering mozzarella was the one with the combinations that created the best pizza topping.
Is it a surprise? Because me being a... I don't want to go as far as saying I'm a food virgin, but I'm certainly not...
Luddite.
I am a food Luddite. I would have thought it was obvious that the traditional pizza cheese, mozzarella, is the best cheese to use on pizza.
Well, no...
Even when judged by a robot's face.
It's not just the mozzarella, though. It's combining the mozzarella with other different cheeses in order to create... Because mozzarella on its own kind of blisters, but doesn't brown... In the way that people like their cheesy pizzas to look.
Right.
So it's the combination that gets the right amount of blistering and browning to kind of create that bubbling, delicious thing that makes you really just want to take a big bite out of the pizza.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the cathedral of food, it's... I was trying to go for a Jesus Christ pun here. I haven't got one. So we'll move on. That's really interesting. And Katie's story about robot eyes determining the ultimate pizza cheese combo can be found on wired.co.uk. If you search cheese, you'll probably find many other stories about cheese. I imagine Katie's byline is against them all. Well, our last news story for today comes from a conference that Katie went to called The Conference, which is as difficult to factor into a sentence as when I stayed in a hotel called The Hotel in Las Vegas a couple of years ago. And we got some great stories out of this, but there were a couple of sort of tidbits that we wanted to highlight that you learnt from this conference. One of which was actually a big news story for us, got a lot of attention, did really, really well, which was, I think, the head of marketing for Lego saying on stage, "We wish we'd invented Minecraft."
Yes.
Which, while not a surprising thing to hear, is also amazing to hear someone just so blatantly come out and say, "Yes, we saw it. It's basically digital Lego. We wish we'd invented it."
Yeah.
Like, great admission. How was that taken at the conference?
So, I mean, he said it in a very sort of lighthearted way, because basically the context that he said it in was Lego had this kind of challenge, which had really, you know, according to the marketing guy at least, been kind of presented to them by parents who were noticing that their children were spending a lot more time on iPads. Sometimes they were bypassing sort of physical toys completely, but they weren't really using their imagination in the same way that they had, you know, the way that they might otherwise have used it if they were sort of playing with physical toys. They were kind of using it in a more passive way when they were playing games. So what they did was they came to Lego and said, you know, we want to kind of
a digital version of what you basically made when we were
exactly
kids.
So kind of Lego had this challenge, and they've got this kind of radical laboratory called the Future Lab, where they've got 10 sort of mad scientists, and that was how the marketing guy described it as well, who from all over the world, and they're basically kind of given free rein to go off and like come up with whatever they possibly can.
Microsoft has this actually as well.
Yeah, and it works fairly well for them, I think. So, and the only stipulation that they have is that it stays true to Lego's core brand sort of beliefs. So they kind of went through and they were looking at different options to try and digitize the Lego experience, and they went back and they looked at Lego successes over the years, the things that it was built on. You know, firstly obviously the brick, then the kind of the minifigure, and the kind of digital products, which I think in the very early days were a bit successful, but later on not so much, and the robotics, and the wheel as well was another one. Apparently Lego is now the biggest manufacturer of tires in the world.
Wow.
For example. Yes. So, you know, that kind of revolutionized Lego kits when they introduced tires. But what they decided was basically the core experience of Lego is the brick, you know, building. And in the original Lego sets, it wasn't like it is today where you get instructions and you get, you know, you must piece it together in this order doing this. It was more of a sort of free build philosophy where you just kind of had the bricks and you created what you wanted out of it.
And that's basically what Minecraft is.
Yes.
Which I guess is where his comment came
exactly.
in.
Exactly. So the end result anyway was that they've created a product called Lego Fusion, which is, I think, in a pilot project in the States right now, which is basically you kind of you can build houses out of physical Lego. So you build like a facade, then you can take a picture with it, with a tablet or whatever you're playing with, and you kind of create, it's sort of like a Sims-esque type game where you can, you know, you can basically build a town and you can populate it, but you can't, the only way that you can build the buildings that are in the town is to actually build them with physical bricks first.
I see. So it supports both arms of the business.
Exactly.
Sell more bricks and appeal to people who play Minecraft.
Yes.
Well done, Lego. Well, that's going to do it for the news this week. We're going to trundle into a very quick ad break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about rumours, and specifically to respond to the people that think we may have got a bit anti-tech over the last couple of weeks talking about the digital switch-off stuff. We're going to talk about nothing but tech and gadgets for 10 minutes.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team. And you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now, just before I get on, I've noticed a box has appeared in our studio. OK, Katie, have you seen that box there that says pet trackers on the side?
I saw it last week and I'm so excited. I'm just a bit concerned that it's still sealed. I really was hoping that it would be open by now.
I don't understand why anyone would leave a box. And this happens, to be honest, people, this happens at Wired quite a lot. Stuff just appears that just seems incredibly amazing and everyone's just like, oh yeah. Well, that came in the other day. We've done a thing with that. And I'm like, why are we not playing with these things? But there is a box that's just obviously full of some sort of pet trackers.
I think it's because we'd never get any work done. I think that's
yeah,
why.
Maybe.
And also now we're lacking Beezle, so we can't...
Well, we're down one of our four office dogs, but yeah. We have three others that come
yeah,
in. But
we'll need to corner another one and definitely have a play with these.
Well, I may have just scooped them. So maybe a feature about pet trackers in a future issue of Wired. For now, we probably just need to play with those. But actually, for now, we need to continue with the podcast. And we have our one segment today. And of course, because we're talking about gadgets, it's time to lace up the boots, fix the saddle in place, because we're going to ride the Technosaurus. It's not the same without Liv to comment on this... music in the background, but we have had a lot of rumours. We don't really do rumour stories on Wired on the website because they're too easy, basically, and everyone does them, and you can rarely add anything to them when yeah. a part leaks out of China or something like that. But what has happened is that over the last few weeks and months, a lot of leaks and ideas and things are coming out. We also now know that there's going to be an Apple event on the 9th of September, which hasn't officially been released by Apple yet, which means I still don't know if I have to just randomly jump on a plane at some point and go to a conference. But we do have a lot of potential new tech to talk about because it's been a long time since Apple's released any new stuff. But on the cards for potential reveal in the next 2 or 3 weeks... are the iPhone 6, which is rumoured to come in two sizes. Mm-hmm. Both are bigger than the current model. The yep. iPhone 6 4.7-inch,
yep.
which is the same size as the HTC One, the first HTC One, I believe, the one that came out. And then there is the... What's the other one? The 5.5-inch
right,
iPhone 6,
yeah.
which means it's bigger than the Samsung Galaxy Note.
It's a phablet.
It's an Apple phablet. And we've also heard rumours of a 12-inch iPad. So that would be an iPad around the same sort of screen size as Microsoft's new Surface Pro 3. Mm-hmm. There's the Lenovo Mix 2, which I believe is about 12 inches. And the Samsung... I never know with Samsung. Mm. They've got a tablet that's about 12 inches. And so that could be very interesting. That's been rumoured for a while, but more rumours have come recently from some reputable sources. And then there is also the iWatch.
Of course. The Apple mysterious iWatch that we've been waiting for 2 years now.
Yes. And Walt Mossberg, who has very, very close personal connections to Apple, reported that it was originally going to be announced in October, and now they've moved it back to September, or moved it forward to September, which means that it would tie in with the launch of the iPhone 6. And obviously, of course, there's iOS 8. So I wanted to just go through a few of these, and because Katie and I are both gadget-obsessed people, and Liat's not here to get annoyed by us talking only about tech, but we get a lot of email from people saying, talk more about gadgets. So we're going to do that today. We're going to talk about some gadgets. iPhone 6, firstly... probably a good thing that it's getting larger. I used a Galaxy S5 for a couple of months because I've never really used an Android phone as my main primary only phone. I've always used them on and off when they've been released, but I decided to put my main SIM in that and just use it for almost 3 months, I think, and I really liked it. But when I went back to the iPhone, I did find it to be a bit small.
Yeah.
And I liked that bigger size. So 4.7 inches sounds brilliant to me.
Yes, I think that's actually probably my ideal size of phone. And I think that you're right. I think the iPhone does feel a bit small now. And in a way, it's quite nice because I know that I could hold it in one hand and operate it properly. But I'm kind of past that. Like, I need the bigger screen, I think.
I agree completely. And the photos that we've seen, so loads of photos of this have been leaked. And it's a very different design to the existing iPhone, and it looks like the design philosophy Apple has been developing with its iPad range, first with the iPad mini and then with the iPad Air that took on the mini's design cues, has moved into the iPhone world. So it looks like a 4.7 inch iPad mini, basically, which is a very nice look. It looks a lot thinner, and it looks like it's got a bigger camera, a bigger flash on the back. It's the same aspect ratio as the current iPhone, so it's still a perfect 16:9 or rather 9 by 16 screen resolution, so screen size, but obviously larger diagonally to be almost an extra inch from corner to corner. So that's very interesting, I think. And the resolution obviously has gone up in accordance.
Yes. Do you know if there have been any more rumours about the camera at all yet? Or
there have been a couple of rumours. So there are three fairly credible photographs of prototypes that have leaked.
Yeah.
Each one seems to have had a slightly different camera module.
Ooh, that's interesting.
And on the first one that we saw, it protruded quite a bit. Okay. Almost like if you put it down on its back, you could sort of rock the iPhone if you held it from opposite corners
right.
to the camera.
Yeah.
Because the actual camera on this side gave that bit a raised profile.
Yeah.
But on the most recent ones we've seen, it's almost flush with the back of the phone. And Apple has had a protruding bit on devices before. The iPod Touch had one. So it's not against their principle to do that, but they need to find a balance, literally.
Oh, yeah.
I think.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to see what that will be able to do, because for me, the iPhone camera has always been the best and continues to be. So, you know, hopefully that will only get better with this generation of phones.
I think it'll have a larger sensor, and I think it will record 4K video.
Ooh.
Because that's now a thing.
Yeah,
lots of devices recording 4K, even though the quality might not be very good. There are rumors, and on the 5.5 inch, it's been rumored that the Retina screen resolution would be actually three times that of the original Retina display, which would give it a crazy high resolution and would better justify doing 4K, because you'd be able to take advantage of that resolution more on the screen. And the rumours are presently that the larger one might have a bit bigger and better processor and be much more like the iPhone Pro or something like that.
Right.
So it stands to reason that maybe had you know, better optics or something like that. But that's all we know at this point. Obviously, there are plenty of places on the web to check out these photos. If you Google iPhone 6, you'll be presented, I'm sure, with a deluge of choices where to get your leaked photos from. The 12-inch iPad is next.
Yeah.
Do you think the iPad Air is too small, Katie?
I don't personally, but, you know, I use an iPad mini, so...
Mm. Well, the mini outsells the Air.
Yeah, and it's the perfect size for me. So it's interesting that if Apple choose to produce an even bigger iPad, but I presume what they would be doing is taking on Microsoft's Surface head-to-head.
Well, that's the weird thing, because
power use
Microsoft
device.
For some reason I still find a little bit baffling, pictures the Microsoft Surface Pro 3, which we've got in the office, and it's brilliant, and graphically it plays games, it's pretty good for games. They pitch it as a competitor to the iPad Air, to the MacBook Air. So it would be interesting if Apple came out with a massive iPad, because it would basically then be competing with the iPad line. God, I'm so sick of getting these mixed up. The MacBook Air line, and we've also heard rumors of a 12-inch MacBook Air with a Retina display this week as well.
Ooh, so I want that.
Yes, that could be interesting. So no photos of that leaked so far, but the rumors there have been standing for a while. And then the last one is just more of the iWatch, of course. Apple, it seems almost dead cert at this point that Apple is going to be producing an iWatch, and that we're going to at least see it in September, even if we can't buy it immediately in September.
Yeah.
It could be one of these things where they show it off and they release the SDK for developers to start building apps and things like that, and then release it the following spring or
a few
months later or something. And it wouldn't surprise me if we saw that with the iWatch. But either way, I think an Apple iWatch could be a very interesting topic. We've talked about that in the past. We're not going to go into too much detail now, but
no, I mean, I'm quite excited for this, because I am yet to be convinced on smartwatches in general, and I really want Apple to just produce something that's going to completely blow me away, and that I'm going to, you know, that they're going to make me really, really want it.
But, you know, I can read the subtext in that. It's like, oh, I don't need this thing. I really wish somebody would make something that gave me a reason to need it.
But
that is consumerism right there.
I
don't need this product. I wish someone would invent something that made me feel like I need it, so I would spend money on it.
I feel like Apple's kind of masterful at making things that people didn't really think or know that they wanted, and making them the most desirable objects.
I think
and
well,
I really
though,
want them to do that again.
I think a big part of that is Apple's very good at creating things that there isn't a need for, and then people develop things that make those products something that you need.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've seen that. Best example is obviously with the iPhone and apps, but by extension, the iPad education, reading, that sort of thing, I think, as well. Well, let us know what you think, obviously, whether you think the idea of a larger iPhone is good. Is 4.7 inches too small still? Is 5.5 inches too large for a phone? Do you want a 12-inch iPad? What use could a 12-inch iPad have for you or somebody maybe that you know or could at least picture in your mind's eye? podcast@wired.co.uk. We can come to some suggestions next week. And with that, it's time to jump into the feedback loop.
Hello, Wired podcast team, says Philip Gregory. I've been listening to your fantastic podcast for a while, and in amongst my smirking and sniggering, I have a suggestion for Nate.
Ooh.
Nate, in your quest to avoid notifications on wearable devices, I found a very simple solution. Use a Windows phone.
I tried that. It doesn't work.
Well, I guess it does work.
Yeah, I suppose it does.
But it really depends, I suppose, whether Windows phone is for you. Anyway, Philip continues, I have a Pebble watch from their Kickstarter launch, and I have the benefit of the cool watch faces and multiple alarms, but I have no pesky notifications, as Microsoft haven't bothered to write an app for Pebble.
I suppose it's quite a good idea in a way. Sort of, if you don't want notifications or certain annoying features, why not buy something with fewer features?
Yes.
I don't know what he's saying. Now, I did use Windows Phone for quite a while.
Yeah.
At one point, but I need the games, and I think that, you know, all the main bases are covered on Windows Phone. You know, the big ones, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Evernotes, blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't, the developer community isn't really energized around Windows Phone. So the big companies are happy to make their apps for the smaller market share. Mm. But the innovation is either in Android or iOS, and that's not great for me.
But it's a very good point. It is. Philip also says, on another note, a couple of episodes ago, someone had written in about the etiquette of device use on holidays. I'm in Madeira at the moment and think it is hilarious watching people attempt to eat breakfast or dinner while keeping up with their virtual lives. I've taken to leaving my device in the safe. It's a holiday for a reason.
Very well said.
Yes, we definitely agree with you, Philip.
We do. We do indeed. Well, we've also had an email here from Natasha. Natasha actually tweeted me the other evening, and she says, hi Nate, Liat and Katie. Missing Liv already. Well, you're going to miss her and Liat, I suppose, today. I started listening to your podcast a few months ago and now have become addicted. Excellent. I work in the world of technology and find your discussions refreshing compared to the marketing jargon I come across on a day-to-day basis. I wanted to write in about a topic that was covered by Liv and Liat quite some weeks ago concerning a company developing software that will verify a person's age using social media sites in order to give them access to adult content. This horrified me. Says Natasha. Surely we have our priorities completely upside down. Instead of looking towards technology and companies to provide us with an iffy software fix for things like this, shouldn't we be encouraging parents to take steps to learn how to be much more aware of how to protect their children online as a whole? After all, it was pointed out by Liat, and quite rightly, that things like this only ever cover a small amount of websites. Wouldn't it be much better for all concerned if there was more emphasis on educating parents around technology and making the learning experience much easier for parents unfamiliar to tech than some half-baked solution? I see so many parents struggle to protect their children online, especially when in most cases their children are much more computer literate than them. Just a thought, loving the show, Natasha. Wholeheartedly agree.
Yes, I would say.
But a bit of both, I think. A little from column A and a little from column B.
Yeah, and I think it's right that parents do struggle to protect their children online, partly because their children do quite often know and understand more than they do, just because, you know, they're naturally more curious and they learn more at that age.
Yes.
So, you know, I think there is a definite struggle there too.
100%, absolutely. Well, we've got another email that came in here, and I think this is an email that could be filed under the headline Calling My Bluff, because when we've been talking about our notifications and our sort of tech obsessions and things, I've on a couple of occasions used my own brother as something of an extreme example in my head of never switching things off. And it's always been in a slightly kind of pointing him out sort of way. Well, he's emailed in response to this. Go ahead, Katie.
I am Nate's brother, and given the abuse I've received about my texting habits on the past few episodes, I felt it was about time I defended myself from this unprovoked attack.
Should probably point out, I'm pretty sure he has his tongue in his cheek here. I hope.
For one, I am not, as you say, constantly staring at my phone in conversations, but rather will occasionally glance at it if it happens to be in my hand and if it happens to show a notification. This, of course, isn't because the conversation I'm having with you isn't interesting, but rather by getting rid of the notification, I can focus my attention on our conversation without thinking about what's going on my phone. Same goes for the smartwatch. By being able to see at a split-second glance what a notification is, I don't have to interrupt a conversation by looking at the phone and can therefore relax and talk more freely. I think the word relax is kind of key there.
Yeah, true. Maybe a balance of the two viewpoints here possibly could go some way to being the advisable amount to do things. But I'd always appreciate the feedback. I suppose that teaches me right for using him as an example in two episodes and then thinking he wouldn't email in.
Well, he does say you're just as bad and you know you are. So there you go.
Told. Well, thank you very much, Andrew. We've also got a couple here that I wanted to mention. This comes in from Jamie, who says, just listen to the podcast where you mentioned the tablet ban at football stadiums. You mentioned the lack of terrorism cases at airports and wondered why there was such a focus on checks at airports. Come on, people, seriously, put the two together. It's not rocket science. Very few cases are directly proportional to the security they have in place. If security was more relaxed and we had more cases, I'm sure many people would be saying, I can't believe security at airports isn't tighter. These people can't win sometimes. Thanks, Jamie. Occasionally annoyed, but always addicted, wide podcast listener. He was also one of the people that pointed out that we might have been talking a little bit too much liberal nonsense and that we should argue more. Ooh. We are a fairly liberal-minded group, it has to be said. But that is, Jamie, why we welcome people in the feedback loop that don't agree with what we say. That's why we read your emails out and we like them, because it does help us keep perspective and it helps everyone get a more balanced viewpoint if perhaps we agree a little bit too much with each other. So thank you very much for writing in. If you want to write in and have your say on the podcast, that can be done by emailing podcast@wired.co.uk. You can see what we did there. And Liat will be back. Actually, Liat won't be back next week. Maybe we should get a special guest for next week.
Yes.
Maybe we should get my brother to come in.
Yes, and defend himself.
Defend himself in person.
His terrible actions.
But yes, let us know what you'd like us to talk about, obviously, of course, on our Facebook page, Wired UK, or email us podcast@wired.co.uk. I've already done that bit, but it's worth saying twice. See you next week.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.